Session number 4653.
This is Grinley Reel 4. We've talked a lot about food. What we haven't talked about is drink. What arrangements were there to quench your thirst?
The supply of water was good to start with, and then as it went off, and then we had, during the summer, we had water only 3 days at a time.
What was the source of supply of water?
The reservoirs. Then we had to fill up every receptacle we had and make it last out the 3 days. But as for drinking, you brought to mind, we had a ration of hot water and we had thermos flasks. I don't know where they came from, but everybody had a thermos flask. And this we filled up twice a day, and I'd forgotten, but we had a ration of tea, Chinese tea. So we were able to make tea, and it was Chinese tea, green. We just had that as such with no milk, no sugar, nothing. But one thing I'd remembered, we used to make coffee. We used to roast soya beans until they were black and then grind them in the rice grinder and make ersatz coffee. And that we used to use with the Chinese brown sugar. And that was lovely.
The real thing?
No, not really, but still it did very well. But as regards alcoholic drink, the only thing I can remember was if anybody had a birthday or something special, they sometimes smuggled in a bottle of Chinese wine, rice wine. But other than that, nobody attempted to make any wines or anything like that. I just don't think it occurred to them.
The water supply.
The water supply. It's piped from the reservoirs to the flats and blocks. So there was a running water from taps. But then, in Hong Kong, during the summer, the reservoirs get very low, so they have water restrictions, and the Japanese then cut off the water. And we only had running water for 3 days a week. And for that time, we had to get sufficient water by us to last for the remainder of the week.
And was the water collecting done communally for the block?
No, you were able to get it from the tap. The taps were running for 3 days, and it was up to you then to get sufficient water to last yourself out. It was each person's own responsibility.
I see.
To get their supply of water in.
So how well off for you were for water depended on
how much you could collect from the taps.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, people with very few receptacles must have been a little bit cheesed off.
A lot of them didn't bother very much about bathing or things like that. Mm. But
like to talk about money for a little while. All the sources of
money. Mm.
Purchasing power that were available to you, both money and barter. Mm. How much were you able to bring into Stanley with you when you first went there?
Well, only what happened to be in your pocket or your purse. We had no time to get any money by us, and in any case, we'd have had Hong Kong money then, and it wouldn't have been any use, because the Japanese wouldn't accept Hong Kong money. That was finished.
Mm.
I don't think we were given any allowance by the Japanese. I'm pretty certain we were not. I don't know. We got our money by selling our gold and all the other articles that we had.
Any personal possessions?
Any personal possessions of, as I told you, cutlery, anything like that. Mm. If people had money, don't ask me how they got their money, because I don't know. I only know how I got my money.
Mm. What was the procedure? Was it a standard procedure by which you sold your things?
Oh, yes. There were only various people that were in touch with the go-betweens, the people that passed.
Now, I know absolutely nothing about this. So
well, you see, if you had something to sell, you would approach a certain person and say, well, look, I've got so-and-so. Now, what is that going to bring me? He would go to somebody else who would go to the Japanese guard. And then he would say, well, I'll give you so much. And then you came back and said, right, well, I'll accept that. But the money came through the Japanese guards in the first place. Except they had a system later on where if you had any money, Hong Kong money, in the Hong Kong and Shanghai bank, you told these people how much you had.
Who are these people?
I don't know. That's why everything was kept. They came on the ration lorry.
Were they British?
Chinese, I think.
Chinese.
Because the Chinese used to bring the rations in under Japanese guard. And they would smuggle in this money. Now, it must have been through a syndicate of English people, because after the war, they put in a claim for the money that you had had. And we had at the time $200 in the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, and we were given the equivalent of that in yen. Now, that lasted us a long, long time.
A lot of purchasing power there.
Pardon?
That was quite a lot of purchasing power.
Well, not really, because I think the Japanese had downed the Hong Kong dollar so much you didn't get very much for it. But still, it was money.
Yes. In dealing with these Chinese people, I mean, what security did you give them against
None
them?
None at all.
You said, I have $200 in the Hong Kong bank, and then they just gave
they
you the
They just
equivalent
gave it to you, yes.
You didn't sign anything?
No. Oh, we signed an IOU. We signed an IOU. But the original syndicate, I don't know what happened to that, but when they finally sent in their claim, it was not the people who had lent the money in the first place. Well, I know for a fact that the majority of those people were executed anyway for their activities in getting money and getting information out.
So these IOUs changed hands?
I don't know how many times they must have changed hands. But it was all very dubious. It was years after we'd been repatriated that these IOUs came up. Not the original ones.
You mean not the ones you had signed?
No. There was no signatures or anything. And we wanted to find out more about it, but as soon as you wanted to make any inquiries, you didn't want to know.
Did you pay?
No. I mean, we'd have been quite happy to pay the original people, but you couldn't get any information as to who or why.
Uh-huh.
We knew in the camp who had given us this money, but they weren't the people that were asking for it back.
So in effect, you had $200 worth of purchases for nothing.
Yeah, we did.
That was
nice
for you.
It was nice for us, yes.
And did you still get your $200 from the Hong Kong bank?
Yes, after the war, the account was still there.
That was marvellous. Nice surprise.
Wow.
Were there any other sources of money apart from the ones you've mentioned?
I don't think so. Let's say I just can't remember any.
I was thinking about, you know, selling services like, you know, making
boots. Well, no, that was all on a barter system.
Yes, okay, well, we'll deal with barter in a minute. What about the relief payments? Did you receive any relief payments through the Red Cross or through the protecting power?
No, nothing.
Okay. I wonder how quickly money lost its purchasing power as commodities became scarce.
Well, as time went on, naturally, it became less and less.
Give me some examples.
Well, it was the price of gold. That rules everything. And as time went on, the supplies to the canteen got less and less. So therefore, your purchasing power was limited. And a lot of that was one of the things that the person who had done all this selling of gold and that, he was left at the end with suitcases full of yen, and they're absolutely useless.
Who was that person?
I was told I mustn't mention names.
Okay.
That was Mr. Blumenthal, if you want to know.
Oh, he was the fellow who wasn't too popular.
That's right, he was the one.
It's funny, isn't it?
Where he got landed with umpteen, I don't know how much yen, and it was useless to him.
Yes. Tell me a bit more about his operations, because he was quite a businessman, wasn't he?
Oh!
What sort of things did he get into?
Everything. You name it, he was in it.
Well, you name it.
Food, money, drink, If you wanted anything, you approached him and he was the one that organized it, if it were possible, for a price.
Was he regarded as a sort of useful person who was able to
No, I think everybody disliked him.
What kind of, I mean, was his own personal lifestyle pretty
very
affluent?
Flamboyant.
In what ways? Tell me a bit more about him.
Oh, he was always full of himself, you know, the great I am. Oh, he was a horrible person.
Yes, when you say his lifestyle was very flamboyant, I mean, did you mean he had big fat cigars and...
No, it was just his general attitude. Mm. He didn't flaunt his possessions all that much, but it was just his general attitude. Mm. I am the big I am sort of thing. Mm.
You mentioned that barter was very widespread at Stanley. What areas of commerce were controlled by barter arrangements?
Hair cutting, that was so many cigarettes. Making of clogs, that was cigarettes. The police would do anything for cigarettes. The making of the wedding rings, that was so many cigarettes. I think the men were given a ration of cigarettes, and that's how it... See, that's how you were able to use cigarettes as a form of barter. If you did any mending or any sewing for anybody, so many cigarettes. And then you could use the cigarettes to get what you wanted. So it was a wheel within a wheel sort of thing.
Mm. Mr. Grindley got a cigarette ration then, I presume?
Yes, I'm pretty certain he did get a ration. Not regularly, but I'm certain he did get one. And then you could buy the Chinese tobacco from the canteen, so you could use that for bartering for other things. Now, there was a girl down in the Indian quarters. She was Chinese. She used to get a pumpkin from the guards or something like that. Now, she would sell you that pumpkin for so many cigarettes, or a piece of pumpkin for so many cigarettes. That was the sort of thing.
I get the impression that money was only good in the canteen.
Exactly, yes. Money was only good in the canteen.
Could you not use it anywhere else?
Well, it was no good giving a man money.
For a haircut?
Exactly. No good at all.
Why not? He could spend it at the canteen.
You were only allowed to spend so much at the canteen at any one time. But money, goods, cigarettes were more use to him than money.
Even though he could spend that money at the canteen to buy cigarettes?
Yes, they'd rather have cigarettes.
Hmm. Well, what sort of controls then were there on the amount of money that could be spent in the canteen?
You had tickets. Each person had a ticket amounting to so much. And then you had to work out what you wanted for that amount of money.
What sort of things got you down in Stanley?
Not knowing what was happening outside. And not knowing how long you were going to be there. I mean, you go on from day to day, you think, well, how much longer is this going to be? When's it going to end? Is it going to end? You just thought it was just going to go on and on forever and it would never come to an end. But the only hopeful thing was when we had this map at St. Stephen's.
And what map?
There was a map of Europe hung in St. Stephen's, and the police used to take charge of it, and they had pins and a little piece of red wool all round the boundaries of where the Germans and the Russians were. And the information used to come in the Chinese newspaper, and each day they would move these pins. Well, when we finally saw that the pins were getting closer together and our people and the Russians were meeting up, we think, well, what's happening now? And people began to be a little bit brighter then.
Was this?
And the Japanese, they never twigged that this was going on. And I don't know, nobody ever seemed to know why. Why did they allow that map to be up there? They wouldn't allow us to have personal newspapers, but Mr. Jimson was the only one that was allowed a newspaper. And I suppose he got it translated and gave the information to the police, and they used it there. But we didn't know why the Japanese ever allowed it.
And it was all quite open?
Oh, quite open. Anybody could go and look at it.
It's amazing.
Yes.
Mm. How much variety was there between individual people? as far as morale was concerned?
Oh, I don't think there was much. As I said, some people got dirty. Some people just gave up, but the majority just jogged along from day to day, hoping for something better.
You have
it wasn't particularly low. It wasn't particularly high.
You have some views about the differences in morale between the men and the women, I think.
Oh, yes. I always felt, mind you, this is just a personal opinion, I always felt that the women coped better than what the men did.
In what way?
Every way, regards them. The men gave up. They sort of sat and just literally gave up, whereas the women would try and busy themselves with things and generally keep things going. Some of the men, yes, they did. They had discussion groups and what have you. But I think the majority of them did give up.
Can you give me any examples from your personal experience of men who gave up?
There was one ex-military man, I think, from Shanghai. He only had one arm. He was a very well-known man, but I can't remember his name. But he always used to swing a golf club round every morning. And he did this for so long, and then all of a sudden, he just gave in. And he'd gone. He died. One of our own prison officers did exactly the same thing. He just literally lay down and died. He wouldn't eat. He didn't want to do anything. And that was his lot. But there's not... They are two that I know of.
Were there any cases of suicide?
No, none at all. Unless you can call that suicide. It was rarely.
Yes. What practical measures was it possible to take on Stanley Camp in order to help keep camp morale up? What kind of things
would
you do?
The women tried to keep themselves as nice as possible and keep their hair neat and tidy. We just didn't let ourselves run to seed. And these little picnics on the hillside, when you talked about what you'd done before and what you were going to do in the future, they all helped keep things going. And I think the men sort of discussed what they were going to do after the war. They always surmised that we were going to come out on top. I don't think anybody ever thought that the Japanese were going to be there for good.
You said the ladies wouldn't let themselves go to pot. That must have been a bit difficult sometimes.
It was difficult.
How did you manage to, you know, look after your appearance?
Well, keep yourself clean, keep your hair washed and combed, and if you had a little lipstick, well, that was fine. You could manage that. But most of the women managed to keep themselves pretty well, I think.
Any camp facilities, like a hairdresser shop?
Oh, no, nothing like that. But there were people who would cut your hair for you and trim it and what have you. But no perms or anything like that, nothing like that, no powder.
You said you had ballets. I was extraordinarily surprised to hear that. Who provided them? What were they like?
Not ballets as such. They called it a ballet, but this Carol Bateman... She was a ballet teacher in Hong Kong, and she put on these shows. The best of the one was Esther from the Bible. And Bee Bacino, she was the top pianist in Hong Kong. She was a marvellous pianist.
Bee Bacino?
Bee Bacino, yes.
Is that a Chinese name?
No, I don't know what nationality. Bacino, it sounds Italian.
Yes, doesn't it?
Something like that. Anyway, there's a piece of music that every time I hear it, it makes my hair stand on end. Because she used to come, they had a piano in the clubhouse, and every morning without fail, Bee Bacino would come in and she'd play that piece of music. And I say, every time I hear it, my hair crawls. But anyway, she and Carol Bateman got together. Carol Bateman got the read the story and sort of put it into mime, and the other person set the music to it. The costumes, Oh, I don't know. We found evening dresses and sort of made up these costumes. The police were all in it as well. The men were in it. Everybody was in it. And it was a marvellous show. It really was. And of course, the Japanese had the front seats. And we played God Save the King, and they didn't know what it was all about.
How did B. Bacino spell her name?
There were two C's in it.
B-I-C-C-I-N-O.
Something like that. Mm.
You said that there were piano and violin recitals as well.
Yes, they had. There was another woman and a man. I know he had a beard. He was thin as anything, but he was a marvellous violinist. And they used to practice in the club, and then the big shows were given up at St. Stephen's Hall.
St. Stephen's Hall was the centre for most of these.
Yes, that was the largest. We had a small hall, but St. Stephen's College, it was a college for Chinese. And that was the largest hall in the camp. So that was where all these shows were given.
And choirs. Choirs as well.
Yes, there was some. There was a white Russian contingent of the police. They were the Russians that were, I don't know how they came, but they came down from Shanghai. I think it was something to do with the Russo-Japanese War or something. They called them the White Russians, and they were part of the police, and they had the most marvellous voices. Every Easter morning, they used to sing, and it used to, marvellous.
In Russian?
Yes, in Russian.
Would that be in the open air, or was there
open
a church?
Air. No, the open air. No, if we had a church service, that was in St. Stephen's Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, the Catholic priest used to say Mass in the clubhouse every morning.
I was reading that there was a contingent of Irish Catholic priests who did quite a lot of social kind of
That's
work.
That's right, yes, they did.
Tell me a bit more about their activities.
I didn't really come into contact with that.
Okay. What kind of things did you personally do? I mean, we talked about some of the things that were going on, but what were your personal occupations to keep yourself occupied, keep your own morale up?
Well, unravelling jumpers and re-knitting them and keeping the place clean, doing a little bit of cooking and going out and meeting with friends on the hillsides in the good weather, having people up to the room and sometimes invite. We had a couple of men there without their wives that we'd known before the war started, and met up with them again, and about once a week they would come up and I'd make a cake, you know, rice cake and soya bean coffee, and they would. It was a treat to them. We had one armchair in our room to come up and sit in an armchair and have a table and a drink from a cup instead of a can, and they thought that was marvellous. So that's what we used to do. Socialise generally, I suppose you could say.
Yes. Now, you've told me that there was quite a lot of provision, both for adults and for children, of classes of one kind and another. How was the educational side of life on Stanley organised? What was available?
Nothing very much. It was only the books that the nuns had been able to collect from the flats. A few atlases and French books and what have you. And don't think there were many children of school age, really. So I think they just did what they could for them, which wasn't very much, really. See, the majority of the children were infants that had been born just before the war, or a lot were born during the camp.
What classes were available for the adults?
They were mostly discussion groups. I don't know what they discussed, politics or what have you. I don't know. I wasn't involved in that.
There weren't sort of formal classes where you could go
no,
and
no.
do French or
Oh, no, nothing formal. They just used to sit in a ring on the grass. And that was it.
I would have thought with such a large number of people as you got at Stanley that, you know, there would be people who were teachers who were experts
yeah. in every yes. field, but I think it was just general apathy, and people hadn't the strength, I don't think, to do these things.
So as far as you're aware, very few arrangements for vocational or educational classes?
I don't think so, no.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that the Japanese were responsible for were the security arrangements
yes.
for Stanley. Can you describe what the security arrangements were?
Surprisingly little, really, because they only had these sentry boxes round the perimeter of the camp, and they were guarded night and day, and there was a barrier, because Stanley is a peninsula, and so they were able to cut that off by putting a barrier across the road, and that was the only security arrangements there were.
Mm-hmm. Was discipline discipline in the camp by the Japanese, was it very strict?
Not really, no. The only thing they insisted upon was if you met a Japanese face to face, you had to bow. And that was the only thing. So everybody tried to avoid them as far as possible.
What happened if you didn't?
Got your face slapped, regardless of age or anything.
Were there any other crimes, as it were, which the Japanese would punish if they detected them?
Well, if they'd have detected them, yes, I suppose they would, but nobody ever... If anything happened in the camp, which I don't think it did really, nothing serious, it would have been kept quiet and kept away from them. But the only thing, as I told you, somebody went to get their rations from the up the hill, and they just booted him all around the compound.
Why?
Well, he'd gone out of his turn. They hadn't told him to take the rations, and he just bent down to get them, and they just yelled at him. And then, because they used to wear... they were funny. They were very short, and they had these huge boots. And you'd see them walking around, you could see all boots and no man. And their swords, of course. Boots and swords.
Are there no other occasions when you can remember internees being punished by the Japanese for some offence?
The only mass, I don't know whether you'd call it punishment, was when they made a standout on the parade ground at the side of the jail for 2 hours while they searched the rooms, because they had an idea there was a radio, and there was. But they searched every room in that camp and had everybody on this parade ground for about 2 hours. And we didn't know why we were there, not until afterwards.
Mm. Yes. It's interesting, your story of Stanley doesn't really make the Japanese seem so hard and severe as one hears from other sources.
Well, I don't think we did have such a hard time in Hong Kong as they did in Singapore. For one thing, you see, the climate was with us. In Singapore, it's hot all the time. And the mere fact that we were at Stanley with the water, sea all around us, and it was a healthy place, I think that contributed a lot. And I still maintain that the Japanese were a little bit afraid of us. I don't know where I get the impression, but I just get the idea that... because they just didn't like tall people. No way. They've seen a Japanese get a stool and to get high enough to slap a man's face. Now, that was the funniest thing you ever saw.
Apart from the Japanese and problems of security and discipline, as far as they were concerned, the administration of the internment camp by Mr. Jimson must have involved an element of controlling behaviour, disciplining people, things like that.
I suppose it did, but I don't really know anything about that. Apart from the fact that he was the head of the community sort of thing.
Well, the Hong Kong police were interned with you. Did they not have a role as far as discipline was
concerned? I think they kept them kept it amongst themselves. I think they got in trouble with the Japanese once or twice for various things, but nothing really serious, I don't think.
We've talked about relations with the Japanese before. Did you find there was much variation in the attitudes of individual Japs?
Some were good, some not so good. We had one, he was a Lutheran, and he was very kind and very good.
In what way?
Well, he was reasonable. He would listen. But most of them, they just shouted and bawled and gave their orders, and they weren't, well, they were as you imagine the Japanese to be. Seen pictures of them and that, and they were just like that. They wouldn't go out of their way to do anything or let you have anything, whereas this Lutheran, he was really, he tried always to get things in.
Do you remember any specific examples?
I think they were asking for drugs at the time, but I just don't think they were available, because they wanted all sorts of things.